Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Travel Department. Discover hundreds of unforgettable destinations with expert local guides.
But first this morning, in July last year, James Kilroy was sentenced to life imprisonment for the murder of his wife 4 years earlier at their home in Westport in County Mayo. Their young children lay in their beds as Kilroy strangled and stabbed Valerie. Speaking on the steps of the court just after the trial, her brother David French spoke about how he recalled having to identify his adored sister's broken body and how her life had been taken in the cruelest, most violent and terrifying way possible, and how her death had devastated their family. Well, David's now written a book called For Valerie, where he remembers his sister, but he also points out how the system as it currently stands in Ireland is utterly unprepared to respond to domestic murders like this, and how he feels the system needs urgent reform. And David joins me now. Morning, David. Thanks so much for coming into studio.
Right.
Listen, let's talk about Valerie, your sister. When people ask you what she was like, what was she like?
Extremely capable and a load of fun. Just a good person to have around and a good person to be around. The fun side would come out a lot. She would just have a great take on stuff and kind of lift the atmosphere all the time, but very, very, very capable as well in a whole lot of areas.
Tell me a bit about your family, where you all grew up, how many of you there were.
So, yeah, we all grew up in West Cork. Our parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, they're all Cork. And, yeah, it was a working farm. Dad, agricultural contractor. Mum, national school teacher. And then, you know, kind of full-time homemaker after that. And, yeah, typical West Cork farm childhood.
Now, when Valerie met James Kilroy, you knew and socialised with him, didn't you?
Absolutely. Was
your impression of him?
Funnily enough, like, the word harmless comes up. Kind of bland, inoffensive. I'm not quite sure. I didn't kind of understand what she saw in him, but, you know, what brother ever thinks, you know, a sister's boyfriend is like, yeah, what's the point to him? But, hey, she's happy. And we knew better than to criticise her choice. We'd hear back all about it, so, yep.
And families often interviewed people, you know, where this, you know, there's been violence in relationships, and family members sometimes say they don't notice for a long time. What was their relationship like, first of all?
It seemed kind of a lot of fun at the start. I mean, they'd been around Australia in a camper van. There seemed to be kind of a lot of positive elements. I think it changed then later on, you know, marriage, the house, children, all of that. It became different. We found out more afterwards when we kind of all triangulated, you know, especially when spoke to our own friends.
Did you ever suspect anything?
No, I didn't suspect anything of that magnitude. I would have suspected, like, yeah, sure, there'd be some difficulties. I thought, you know, maybe around finance or the stress of having children or whatever. But I didn't think it was anything like that.
And in terms of, like, who worked the most, childcare, housework, did you notice anything around that or not?
Yes. It was obvious that Valerie was doing everything, inside the house, outside the house, earning, to do with the children. His role seemed to be getting smaller and smaller. And that, looking back, it was like he hadn't grown up into being a 46-year-old man. Married with children. There was still a kind of pleasure-seeking element, a kind of slightly lightweight aspect to that.
For our listeners, when did you first hear that Valerie had died?
That was on the Friday evening. The Gardaí had showed up at my mum's house in West Cork, and thankfully one of my sisters was with mum that weekend, and the Gardaí told her, and then my sister rang me, put the Gardaí on, and, you know, the first I heard was Valerie is gone. And it was like, you know, you kind of go down through the homicide is not the first one you come up with. You know, you're thinking, what do you mean gone? What kind of gone? Car crash, accident, what? Yeah.
So when did you find out what had happened?
So, yeah, Friday evening, found out about that Valerie was gone. And of course, we asked, you know, well, where's James? And the police couldn't say, they did say they had someone in custody, but they couldn't name him. And it was only when I showed up at the Castlebar Garda station the following morning that I found out, yeah, the person in custody is James Kilroy and he's been questioned. So then it was like, yep, that's, the police were fairly clear at that point. And it was obvious afterwards when we learned during the trial about the forensics why they were so clear about it. But it was clear he, you know, Valerie was dead and he had done it.
The terrible thing is, I think you were her only brother. You had to identify, I think, Valerie.
Yes, I had to identify the body. I guess, you know, they could have probably found some other way of doing it, but it was the most obvious, straightforward thing to do. It was kind of the last thing I could do for her.
You know, don't you, what her last words were?
Yes, we, although hard to believe stuff Kilroy had said, because as it came out in trial, he was an unreliable historian. But she said, what about the boys? In at least one account that he had given, he said that, you know, she said, leave me alone. And she said, what about the boys? And that's what we understand would have been her last words. But again, that's his account.
He quickly confessed to the killing, I think. What did he say about his own state of mind at the time? And did he have anything to say in his own defence at the trial?
There was so much recounting of what he had said in the Garda interviews and then recounting of what he had told the various psychiatrists that talked to him afterwards for defence and for prosecution later on. It was almost like he wasn't offering a defence, except that he was kind of saying he thought Valerie was someone else. Like, not that she was someone else, but that she was acting for someone else coming to get him, that she was the leader of some pack of agents. Now, the stories didn't seem to be stable. They were different in later retellings by him. So you kind of track a story getting bigger. Mm-hmm. And things that weren't in the Garda interview were suddenly later on. So his, what he was telling, he very quickly said that he had done it. The Gardaí at one point asked him, you know, they're coming to the end of the 24 hours, whatever they have for questioning someone. And they said, is this the knife you used to kill Valerie? And he says, yes. And you're kind of going, are we done? Like, you know, what is, where do you go from there?
Now, he was sentenced to life imprisonment last year, 5 years after the killing. He's appealing that decision. But is it the case that he is still the legal guardian of his children?
100%. The murder kind of has almost zero effect in that space. The situation when people show up and look at it is you have a widower, man without his wife, and you have children. And it's no more effect on his guardianship than if he'd robbed the car. Literally, there is zero effect on his guardianship. I mean, obviously, he's otherwise occupied and he's in custody, but it does not affect his guardianship in any way. And the problem is that the dynamic in the system is to reunify families. And that makes absolutely perfect sense in practically all cases, except homicide. The reunifying families basically means rehabilitating him and in the eyes of the children as well. And that is something that comes out of the fact we do not have specialist teams showing up after a homicide. You just get people who are used to doing their job, which is reunifying families.
Which is just the system, I suppose, as it is.
Absolutely.
At the moment.
It's the system. Yeah. And I think post-homicide needs to be carved out as something very, very, very different. You know, stealing a car or even attacking some other guy in the street has kind of nothing to do with the relationship with the children. But the missing point is, and it's recognised in our jurisdictions, killing a mother is child abuse. And then you're in a situation where the abuser is still recognised as the legal guardian with all the rights that entails.
You secured a court order, I think, in March, David. Explain that to me. What rights does that give you?
That was the notice party appeal. So I won notice party status, which allowed me to be inside the courtroom when the children are being discussed. Funny, like when you said that, I wasn't sure if you meant the notice party thing or the High Court case that I had to get the legal personal representative status to start executing on Valerie's estate. So normally, you know, a husband is the legal personal representative unless you've written a will. And then he becomes the executor. In this case, he's kind of disqualified, but he wouldn't voluntarily consent to handing over the executorship. So I had to go to the High Court to get that. And this is the kind of, you know, sand in the gears just causing hassle. And it's, yeah, I got in the High Court. I was going to get it anyway, but it cost $6,000 to do it. And that $6,000 comes out of the estate, which, you know, when we get the estate sorted out, it'll go to the children.
So as things stand, David, what claim does he have, say, on the joint assets, such as the house, when he's released? I mean,
so the house is his, 100%. This was highlighted after the killing of Celine Cawley by her husband and all of that Mary LaFoy justice judgment. The legislation in that space hasn't caught up. I mean, it makes sense in most cases. If one spouse dies, the other person owns the house. There's no inheritance. And that's the difference here. It's not, James Kilroy is not inheriting the house from Valerie. It's already 100% his. So the LaFoy judgment means half would go to him, half would go to Valerie's estate. He may or may not accept that, or he may contest it. That's all ahead. So the book focuses on the sort of the initial crime, the aftermath, the emotional side of it, and then it kind of shifts gears into some of, you know, these kind of issues, which in a way are dry and boring, but they're the kind of thing that drive more trauma into the victim's family and further disadvantage the children going forwards. And the story isn't unique. I mean, it jumps out in the book. There's this, the only thing unique about this story is that she's called Valerie French. You know, there's 274 women killed since 1996. I think it's up in the 280s at the moment. It's a regular thing. It happens every maybe 6 or 7 weeks in Ireland on average. Yet the system seems to pretend it never happens. And that's the kind of thing that I'd like to call out.
And does that add to the grief you're already all suffering?
It does. It adds to the grief because you feel that something has happened and the rest of the world doesn't even realise that is not that this thing didn't happen, that this whole class of events doesn't happen, that wife killing isn't a thing. So, you know, especially when you're, you know, you've identified the body, you've had trials, there's been a verdict, and yet the system is still living in a world where this terrible crime never happens. That adds to the grief because you kind of think, why is this not being acknowledged? Why are so many roadblocks kind of showing up in front of you all the time?
Because put simply, I mean, you make the point in your book, which is great for Valerie, that the family of the murderer, they almost enjoy an advantage over yours and your family during the various trials. I mean, without mentioning anyone else, I suppose, what form does that advantage take? And what were the limits, I suppose, on your family, what you could say or do?
So I think that's exactly the question. Where exactly are the limits? I mean, the standard advice is say nothing. You could queer a trial. You don't know what you might say. You can't talk to journalists or whatever and say, like, you know, they might ring you up and say, can we do a piece on Valerie? Mm-hmm. Oh, no, it's nothing about trial. And like, I don't know what I can say. So you have to say nothing. You might know stuff. You can't say it. So the perpetrator's side, his supporters and associates, can be putting out and trying out all the stories they want. And you have to stay silent. And that makes it look as if you kind of agree, as if you're going along with it, because people think, well, you know, if David had something different to say, then he'd pipe up. And they don't realise that you are silenced until the verdict happens. So part of the reason for writing the book is kind of go, look, you're silenced for 5 years. You're sitting there thinking, well, I can tell the piece of paper what happened. And then as soon as the verdict lands, you're like, right, we're off. We can tell the story now. And that's exactly the same thing that other people experience, other victims' families experience, because there's no victim until the verdict lands. Mm-hmm. You know, Valerie isn't James Kilroy's victim until he's convicted of manslaughter or murder. So there's no victim's family as such. You have no special rights or anything. You're the same as the rest of the public.
And also, we spoke about, obviously, her children a little earlier. But in regards to those children, just to clarify this, you know, what rights, therefore, do you have under law as their uncle? Do you have any?
Zero. Nothing. The situation is bizarre. I mean, if you are caring for children, say for 6 months or a year, you can step in to be their guardian. But why would I have been minding the children if my sister was alive and minding them? So a lot of the system is built pretending that this doesn't happen. The guardianship dies with Valerie, and we're no more, we're just kind of an identity resource that might know what her life was like previously, but purely a resource that can be reached out to. There's zero rights per se. Zero. Absolutely. You're lucky if you're kind of recognised by the system. System locks onto the family. Even now, the system is locked onto the family, being James Kilroy and the children, and you have to literally fight to get in.
So you effectively think, as we close, that this system is totally skewed against the family of the person who's been killed by their spouse?
It's, yes, basically. Mm-hmm. It's, the victim's family isn't a thing. It's a phrase, but there's no legal standing at all. The legal standing of the perpetrator continues in the childcare and property space. So it's not like any rights should be given to us. It's that a right of guardianship should be suspended when a verdict like that is handed down. And it's important, like, the person is still available. If social workers or anyone involved in the system thinks that, you know, James Kilroy is a useful resource, you know, whatever notion they have in that regard, if they think he's a useful resource for children, he's totally there. You know where to find him. But he can't reach out. You know, if you had a suspension of guardianship, it would remove rights from him. The property side, you know, that should have been sorted. There's reports upon reports about that. Mm. Chris Cawley is the expert in that space.
Mm, they could change the law, I suppose. That's what you're all hoping for.
There's multiple changes of law. Law Reform Commission 2015 did a prevention of benefits of homicide report, which has a whole heap of recommendations. The 2023 report after the Claude Hall murder, the title, I have to have it in front of me because I can never remember it. That's got like 188 recommendations. Department of Justice is working their way through that at the moment. Right. We have meetings fairly regularly. Valerie's law is one of those things. The suspension of guardianship is recommended. There's a recommendation that, you know, notice party should be given to the victim's family. A lot of these things are known. And I think that's the point of telling the story, because, you know, what other point is there? Because, look, there's plenty of stories that are very, very similar. But having it out there shows and highlights, look, this is the nonsense that happens behind the headlines. You know, you think people say, oh, it's great, you got closure, you got the verdict. You're like, no, this is just the start of half of it. Like, there's a lot of stuff you have to do after that. I mean, if you walk away from it, you're effectively allowing him to win on it and the children to lose. If the children weren't there, you're like, yeah, what? Like, leave them have the house, who cares? But the children's assets and their kind of life going forward and their narrative has to be very clear.
I'm conscious they're young and they have their own privacy, but how are the children doing?
They're doing as well as can be expected, thankfully. And that's great. I saw them actually last Friday. And, yep, football match, happy out, standard, running around in sunshine. Yeah, and that was good. Thanks to a lot of efforts by a lot of people. And yeah, I'd like to give credit to that side of it.
Yeah, which is lovely. Valerie would be very happy about that. Mm. Finally, your great book for Valerie, The Story of My Sister's Death at the Hands of Her Husband and Its Devastating Aftermath. Why did you write it? Did you write it for her to make sure she gets some kind of justice after she's gone? Why did you write it?
To kind of fill in the blanks on her life and not just like yet another stat. There were a lot of particular things about Valerie. And also to break the mold of people thinking that a domestic homicide goes a certain way. I mean, one of the things in the research that jumps out, there's no actual victim type. She's not, you know, they're not necessarily a warrior or a wallflower or whatever. There is a perpetrator type. The victim type could be anyone. And another thing that jumped out was that the homicides in Ireland of women killed in this way, about 40%, there's no advanced physical violence. There's coercive control, there's controlling behaviour. So a lot of women wouldn't necessarily recognise that they're at such a high level of risk. And I think that's the point of telling the story, going, you know, you might have an image of what these things look like. And especially if there's a woman in that situation, they mightn't actually realise that they're in the situation that Valerie was in a week before this happened.
Well, David French, as ever, thank you so much for chatting to me today. And your book, For Valerie, The Story of My Sister's Death at the Hands of Her Husband and Its Devastating Aftermath, is written by you, David French, and is published by Gill. Thanks so much for chatting to me this morning, David.
Thank you.